Crossing the Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, advice is everywhere, but it's not all good. We talk about how to tell if the advice you're getting, whether it's from friends, parents, strangers on the internet, is good or should be ignored. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Wisconsin pilot who will be making a homecoming at this weekend's Milwaukee Air and Water Show.
The U.S. Navy Blue Angels may be the most recognizable group of performing aviators in the world. Flying at up to 60 air shows in North America each year, the F-18 pilots who make up this unit are among the best of the U.S. Navy and Marine Corps. One of the current Blue Angels is a Wisconsin native, Lieutenant Commander Griffin Stengel, who grew up in Madison. Dusty Weiss got to know Stengel while flying with the Blue Angels.
We're cruising along over the Gulf of Mexico at about 500 miles an hour in an F-18 Super Hornet fighter jet. And in the pilot seat in front of me, Lieutenant Commander Griffin Stengel wants to talk football.
Dusty, are you a Packers fan?
Oh my God, yes.
Okay, cool. My wife's a Vikings fan, so we had a rough weekend, but we're working through it, obviously.
Proof that you could take the boy out of Wisconsin, make him an elite naval aviator, and give him the assignment this year of Blue Angel number 6. But you can't take the Wisconsin out of the boy.
Like, I grew up in Madison. I went to Madison West. I am just a person who decided one day that I'm going to follow my passion and try to be the best pilot I can be.
Stengel's journey began 15 years ago. Inspired by a class that he took with Madison pilot Diane Ballwig, he studied aviation at the University of North Dakota and then joined the U.S. Navy. In flight school, he was drawn to the raw power and majesty of flying F-18 fighter jets launched off of carriers at sea.
It's awesome. You could be having the worst day, and as soon as you get shot off the front end, it changes your outlook, and you're just flying, you know?
But flying F-18s is one of the most sought-after roles in the Navy. Stengel says the training and competition were intense. But a decade later, his drive and determination have now earned him a coveted assignment as one of only 260 Blue Angels pilots in history. I wanted to understand just how demanding his job is.
All right, Dusty.
That is why I found myself strapped snugly into the F-18 passenger seat behind Stengel at Blue Angels headquarters in Pensacola.
First leg max afterburner.
Liftoff is like a rocket launch. And over the next hour, Stengel subjects me to maneuvers with names like the Split S and the Half Cuban 8.
This is incredible!
But the real eye-openers are the high G turns, where you experience 6 or 7 times the normal force of gravity. If you don't flex every muscle in your legs and core and breathe just right, the inertia can pull all the blood from your brain and cause you to black out.
All right, we're coming to the right for 6 Gs. Ready, hit it.
The Gs don't come on gradually.
There's 6.
It feels like I'm being hit by 1,000 pounds of sandbags all at once.
We're rolling out. All right, brother, how you feeling?
Oh, man, that was a lot. Started graying out a little bit, but do you get gray during that? Or are you just like cool as a cucumber?
We're pretty accustomed to pulling these Gs all the time.
It's all I can do just to keep it together. But it is clear that Lieutenant Commander Griffin Stengel is undeniably in his element here.
Oh, I remember the first time I took off in an F-18. It's a pretty wild sensation.
Are you going to be spoiled for the rest of your life?
You know, there's that distinct possibility. That just kind of reminds me to take every day, give it 100%, and not take anything for granted. It's a privilege to be working with such incredible people who are so dedicated to giving their all every day. Being able to stay a part of the Blue Angel team is just a true blessing.
For 60 precious minutes, I have the opportunity to experience exactly what Stengel is talking about. Sure, I end up drenched in sweat and panting for breath.
Just like that, we're back on solid ground.
But Stengel's ability to perform under those conditions with a chuckle and a grin leaves me with a profound respect for the incredible drive and athleticism that it takes to fly the F-18. And he says being able to showcase that singular talent for the first time over his home state of Wisconsin is a special experience.
Yeah, it's a real treat flying over a city that was a big part of my childhood. Coming home and seeing the places that I went to growing up, it kind of means a lot, you know? You never forget where you come from.
A return to his roots for a proud Wisconsinite who earned his wings.
Dusty Weiss is host and producer of the Lead Balloon Podcast, and he's based in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Lieutenant Commander Griffin Stengel and the rest of the Blue Angels will perform at the Milwaukee Air and Water Show on July 22nd and 23rd. Now it's easy to find advice in this world. Friends and family, randos on the internet, everyone can be a source of advice, even if you didn't ask for it. So how are we supposed to know if someone's opinion, whether it's a professional opinion or an unsolicited one, is actually worth listening to? Advice giving and taking is an age-old pastime. Historians say advice columns have been around for at least 300 years. Our next guest interviewed advice-giving experts to get some advice about how to figure out what advice to take and what to trash. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What's the best advice you've ever gotten? What's the worst advice you've ever gotten? Do you try to share advice with other people? When and where and when do you just clam up and listen? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Allie Volpe is a senior reporter at Vox. Allie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
What led you to seek advice about advice for your piece, Allie?
Yeah, it's funny. It is a little meta. A lot of what I cover does require me reaching out to experts and getting their advice on a variety of topics. And a workplace discussion kind of veered down this topic of like, well, what advice is good advice? And so I was kind of working with the working headline of advice about advice. So I figure, you know, if we are doling it out, we might as well teach people what advice to take and what to ditch.
Now, in general, there have been some studies on this, and it sounds like getting advice, if we do it right, it can help us make better decisions. What do we know?
Right. Like we all know what we know and we don't know what we don't know. We have our biases. We have our blinders up to certain things. There was studies that actually showed if you got advice from a sports fan who was a fan of a team you weren't rooting for, you made a better bet on how the game would resolve if you, you know, took their advice instead of just going with your gut, hoping that your preferred team would win. So taking advice does help us make better decisions, but we're not very good at taking that advice, even if we've asked for it ourselves, research shows.
How do we make sure we're getting advice that might actually confront our blind spots as opposed to so-and-so thinks, we don't think this out loud probably, but so-and-so thinks like I do, they'll back me up in this decision I'm making, whether it's right or not. How do we make sure we're getting a positive committee, not a yes men kind of committee?
Right. I think it's important to think about who's giving the advice. Is it somebody who has expertise in the area we're looking for advice in? I maybe wouldn't go to my best friend for legal advice if they do not have that sort of expertise. So I think it's important to look at where that advice is coming from, because maybe oftentimes a close friend or a family member might just be saying what they think we want to hear and instead of what we actually need to hear.
Now, if we don't want to hear advice, how can we put ourselves or the advice that's going to help us? How do we put ourselves in a mindset to say, OK, this isn't what I wanted to hear. Maybe I need to take it seriously, though.
So what I found interesting from reporting this piece is sometimes we do get that advice that is like, I don't want to do this. This feels hard. This feels difficult. But sometimes that's what we need to do. I found it interesting that people often take advice when it is it aligns with our life, it addresses a problem, and it's feasible to achieve, and it doesn't have any major consequences or side effects. So sometimes good advice just comes in bad packages. Like sometimes a parent might tell us advice in a condescending manner, or advice might feel that it is too difficult. But sometimes we just need to take a step back and think about it. That bit of advice that we maybe thought was too hard or didn't align with our lives maybe is the thing we should do. I talked to an advice columnist who talked about someone who wrote in asking for advice on whether to ask out somebody who they had a crush on. And so the hard thing to do would to give the advice of, yes, ask out that person. That is a vulnerable thing that sometimes might give us butterflies. It might feel bad, but it's the right thing to do. Sometimes the hard thing or the thing that gives us the negative reaction is the right thing to do.
We asked around here at Wisconsin Public Media. Aaron Cook, one of our HR people, says, the first thing I always try to do is filter the advice through several lenses. Is this advice helpful or hurtful? The result of knowledge and experience versus bias. Is it a judgment or an actual critique on any sort of content? Finally, I consider where the advice is coming from and where I stand in relation to it. Who's the expert? Is this something creative or emotional? A long line of filters there for advice. Allie, Aaron is clearly thinking about ways to figure out what advice is good or not. What did you hear from experts when it came to evaluating advice in those ways?
Yeah, definitely the panel of getting a lot of different opinions was something that experts definitely sang the praises of. Getting a number of different viewpoints helps us to consider all angles that we maybe didn't consider. But then there comes a point where if you are just asking dozens and dozens of people, maybe you haven't really thought about what you actually want. So it is helpful if you can get a clear consensus from a panel of a handful of people. But if you feel the need to keep asking people, you probably just don't know what you want.
We're talking about how to tell if we're getting good or bad advice with Allie Volpe, senior reporter at Vox. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you tell if you're getting good advice or bad advice? Any advice you regret taking or not taking in your life? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about sorting out good advice from bad with Allie Volpe. She's a senior reporter. She wrote about this at Vox. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Ellen is with us in Peterborough. Ellen, hi.
Hi. Oh, this one is kind of odd. I was in a very intense year-long program at Milwaukee Mental Health Complex. I received very good care, and I had a psychiatrist who saw me every week. At the end of that year, his last advice to me was, watch those left turns, Ellen. And as a person who drives a lot, I have found that he was right. But I think it's hilarious that after that, you know, that was his advice.
I love it, Ellen. I thank you for sharing that, Ellen. I like that in part because, okay, we've been through this long experience, but here's some really, I don't know, grounding, very practical advice that's going to help anybody who, in this case, anybody who drives.
Right. Sometimes the most practical thing is the best thing to do. And the advice that sort of takes us by surprise, I find the most memorable and that I will actually use.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Ellen, at 800-642-1234. Yeah, what I hope my kids take away from growing up in my house is careful on the steps, because stairs are great, but yeah, they can be dangerous if you're not careful on them. Now, looking back at the experts you talked to, Allie, sometimes we offer advice when it isn't really being solicited. How can we be careful not to give that unwanted advice?
Right. And I am so guilty of this sometimes. Sometimes all people want is just to vent. They don't want advice. And I found it's actually just really easy to ask somebody straight up, do you want advice or do you just want me to listen? And no one is ever really offended by that. And oftentimes people just want you to listen. And so I make sure when I'm about to vent to a friend or get their advice, I'll often preface it with, oh, I really want your advice on this, or can I tell you about something? And I think that sort of guides the conversation so you're not getting unsolicited advice.
We heard from Susan in Suamico. She says the best advice she was ever given was from her father when she was pregnant with her first. She said the advice was the best thing to spend on your child is time. Oh, I like that. So that's an example of someone with a specific bit of experience. It was her dad talking about child raising. I don't know. Are there good general kinds of advice that we can reach out to and get that kind of wisdom?
I love that bit of advice. Something an expert told me that really stuck out to me was somebody who's in the quote unquote messy middle of an experience often has really good insight, even though they might feel that they don't. So a parent who maybe has toddlers and they're in the middle of it is better suited to give advice about parenting than maybe someone who's an empty nester because you are the one who's actually experiencing it every day.
Let's go back to our callers. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. Well, to follow up on an earlier comment, UPS used to instruct their drivers to make three right turns on a block instead of taking a left to prevent accidents. But my advice, I'm not sure if it was a line in a movie or on a TV show or something from one of my grandfathers or an uncle or my dad, but it was in the context of an Italian restaurant, and it was simply, don't fill up on bread.
I love it, Tom. And have you lived by this rule?
Actually, I've probably strayed from it, but I think that when I think of it, it means the main course is still coming.
Excellent. Tom, thanks a lot for sharing that. We're asking for your best or worst advice ever given or received. Allie Volpe wrote about how we evaluate advice we get. She's a senior reporter at Vox. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Our own Larry Mueller, host of the Larry Mueller Show here at Wisconsin Public Radio, told us, my high school guidance counselor told me I should not attend UW-Madison, but find a smaller school where I'd have a better chance to succeed. I asked my dad about it, and he said I should go where I want, and if I failed, I could try another school. So Larry says, I went to UW-Madison, succeeded, eventually became a full professor at UW, and had a pretty successful radio career on campus, I would add, Larry. Allie, when we're making a big, or at least what feels at the time, like a huge life decision, like where should I go to college or what job should I seek or whatever, what did you learn from the people you interviewed about how to seek out useful advice?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that we tend to favor advisors who are more confident, but those people might not always be the most accurate. So I think it's important to get diverse points of view. Like, we tend to seek out people who are similar to us. So finding people who have a different experience than we do in getting advice can often help lead us in the right direction. So it's funny that the guidance counselor, you know, said one thing, dad said another thing. And so you kind of just take the average of those two bits of advice, which experts say is actually a good way to go.
We'll go back to our callers now. Ganado is with us in Milwaukee. Ganado, hi.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I'd love to see two media sources that I love combined together. I read Allie's articles as well in Vox all the time. But my piece of advice that I wanted to talk about was when I first started grad school, I was not doing super hot because I had just moved to Milwaukee and was starting a new job, and so it wasn't my primary focus in life. I had asked one of my friends who was recently in grad school, like, hey, should I stay with the course or drop it? He suggested that I stay, which not a very good decision because GPA requirements in grad school are very different from undergrad. So I ended up my first semester in academic probation. So, funny story there. I think we both lacked some context, but just wanted to share that.
Well, I hope things got better.
They did. I did graduate, and things turned out fine in the end.
Yay. Okay. Glad to hear that part of it. But, Allie, I think sometimes there's an instinct to say when you give advice, stick to it. Power through. Don't give up. And sometimes giving up, as in the case of Ganado's class, might be the right advice.
Right. And I think that comes back to sort of the criteria that good advice fulfills, you know, whether it solves a problem, is feasible, and doesn't have any consequences. I would argue, you know, spending a lot of money on something that, you know, you might not achieve at is a pretty big consequence or side effect. And therefore that advice maybe isn't the best.
Thanks a lot for sharing that story. I appreciate it. Now, one expert told you, this is in like broadening horizons here, don't just consider advice from people who have succeeded, right? Because that seems obvious. Seek out people maybe in similar situations who have failed in one way or another. Why is that helpful?
Yeah, one expert gave an example of someone who has been divorced and getting marriage advice from them. They can kind of see the other side. They can see where things have gone wrong, maybe things that they would have done differently. Not to say that we should only be seeking advice from people who have failed something, but they have a unique perspective on, you know, things that didn't go right. That same expert also said getting advice from somebody who, you know, is in the middle of something is really helpful as well. Like somebody who's maybe like in the middle of training for a marathon, but they are like exhausted by it. But giving advice to someone who is a little bit less experienced can help like revive them a little bit and get them excited and remind them why they're doing it.
I want to talk about a source of advice that previous generations weren't lucky enough to have access to, random people on the internet. What did experts say about the advice of, you know, the whole planet online?
Yeah, everyone loves to give advice online. And I think it comes down to just some basic media literacy tips. You know, anyone can post a TikTok telling you how to wake up earlier in the morning. And you might feel susceptible to that. Like, yeah, I can achieve so much more if I got up early. But one, you need to think about, like, do you actually want that advice? Or are you just kind of consuming it passively and think that's something that you might need for your life, but it doesn't actually fit in with your schedule. Something else is like that any person online can put up a video, but what is their credentials? What is their expertise? My colleague, Rebecca Jennings, did this great piece about online influencers posting online courses to their YouTube pages, or, you know, getting people to pay money for online courses that they have set up themselves. So do they have any expertise in that? I don't know. Are they just looking to get money? Probably. So if a person is, you know, saying something or doing something to solicit some sort of reaction from somebody, whether that is to be angry or to give them money, I would be skeptical of their advice.
It's a good place to leave it. Allie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Allie Volpe, senior reporter at Vox. She talked to us about her recent article, How to Tell When You're Getting Good Advice. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, businesses are seeing backlash when they get involved in social issues, and that's not a new thing. A historian joins the show to share stories of protests against businesses who embraced civil rights progress in previous generations. And the latest Spider-Man multiverse movie is getting attention for its unique animation style. We'll dig into the history of animated movies, some of the groundbreaking innovations, the big moments, and we're hoping you'll share your favorites. You can get started right now, by the way. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Your favorite animated movie of all time, and maybe why. That and more, it's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, a UW Health psychiatrist joins us to look at racial disparities in mental health care in Wisconsin and what we can do to reduce those disparities. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new survey of Wisconsin businesses shows that their outlook on the economy is improving a bit. We'll talk about what that means for the state's workforce. First July is National Minority Mental Health Awareness Month, and Wisconsin has something in common with pretty much every other state in having troubling disparities in mental health treatment for people of color. A group of Wisconsin health research organizations called Healthy Metric released a report last month identifying many of those disparities around the state and found that Black adults had the highest rate of screening for clinical depression but don't always have the same access to mental health care. Last year, the rate of suicide among Black residents of Milwaukee County hit a 10-year high, and health groups and community leaders across the state are working toward reducing barriers to proper diagnosis and treatment. Our next guest is here to help us better understand why these disparities exist and what we can do to try and overcome them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think causes these racial disparities in mental health? Do you have ideas to try and solve some of these issues? If you're a person of color, I'd love to hear about your experiences with mental health care. And whoever you are, if you're in a part of the state where you've had trouble accessing care, love to hear from you as well. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Keddie Thertis is an associate clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health and a psychiatric consultant at UW Health Pain Management Clinic. Dr. Thertis, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, thank you for having me.
When we talk about disparities in mental health care for people of color, can you give us a sense of what that looks like, how that actually works in practice for people here in Wisconsin?
Yes. So Wisconsin, if you look across the board compared to the rest of the nation, there are some concerning aspects in terms of disparity that are worse for people of color in the state compared to the rest of the states. There are some things that might be better based on access to insurance on recent reports and the expansion of Medicaid. But in general, across the board, there's higher rates of less access to healthcare and a significant impact from the societal and psychological structures that stem from racism.
Can you talk a little bit about access to treatment and what we see around the state when it comes to sheer, like, if somebody recommends you get health care, mental health care, I should say, is it there for you?
Yeah, so interestingly, if you look at everyone across the board, most adults have challenges navigating just understanding the insurance structure and how to find care. And since COVID-19, the access to care has been exacerbated across the board as well. Prior to COVID-19, there are a lot of limitations, and the need has expanded since then in terms of higher rates of depression and anxiety. And it seems like in underserved communities, we're seeing even higher rates among Black people of depression, or screening for depression at least. And so this is going to have a direct impact on the ability to navigate care. Even when you're struggling with your good health, you can have access issues that can stem from your own mental illness, and that can make it a lot more difficult. Right now in Wisconsin, the Parity Act was helpful in expanding Medicaid, but that doesn't always line up with the availability of clinicians. It doesn't always line up with the availability of people who look like you in access to care. And ideally, you would have a clinician with a similar background. This is not always feasible, but this would improve diagnostic assessment and engagement in care in a culturally informed way.
I wanted to ask about that. I'm sorry. I wanted to dig into that in particular, Dr. Theratis. What can we do to have a wider variety of people entering into to becoming practitioners so that people have that option if they need it?
I think there's a good, strong movement towards awareness in Black and Brown communities for the importance of mental health. It's even changed since I first started in school and in training. The amount of awareness has expanded, and it's seen also in social media, which can have a positive and negative impact. But I think stemming from the clinical standpoint of having policy that improves the pipeline of clinicians from minoritized communities and communities of color into college, into medical school, into psychological programming, and also to think about restructuring healthcare in a way that opens up avenues for wellness beyond just the clinic setting and the academic setting and into the community, where there's more opportunities for community empowerment and redefining wellness efforts beyond just the clinic.
We're talking to Dr. Ketty Theratis, Associate Clinical Professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, and a psychiatric consultant at UW Health Pain Management Clinic, looking at mental health care disparities here in Wisconsin. You can join in with your questions, maybe your experiences, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Theratis, can you talk about what that might look like, mental health care not just being in a clinical setting, in the psychiatrist's office, in the community? What could that look like?
So there's been a lot of work about looking at peer providers, people who can function to help people navigate mental health, mental wellness, basics of being mentally attuned to what could be preventative care rather than reactive care. If you look at the medical model, it can function in a very reactive manner where we deal with a problem after it's manifested. But looking at community efforts to engage people in education and awareness about what could look like the early signs of being unwell, deconstructing what unwellness means in the Black community, especially. There's a impetus to be seen as strong, and that if there's any mental health condition, you can have a sense of weakness. if you're religiously based, it could lead to a sense of feeling like you're not believing enough in God or losing faith in religion and God. And so it can be really destabilizing force to reckon with when you feel like you could have mental health issues, but also even understanding what that looks like and how early care and understanding could decrease a lot of distress. And opening up to others in ways that are supported in other areas of life, such as churches. There's really interesting work in Wisconsin by different groups who deal with having mental health care and medical care access in a way to reach people in a barbershop. There's young women's groups and camps. There's engagement by people to build understanding through a way to avoid going to the ER when you're in mental health crisis and perhaps seeking out a more welcoming space in the community related to the church. So there's really a lot of opportunities, and that's happening in Wisconsin right now, to help that process along, to decrease that stigma, improve access.
That's interesting. I've talked to people who have done similar projects in rural or small town Wisconsin, trying to overcome the attitude that, you know, hey, we're self-reliant, we don't need mental health care, and actually peer support. People have been through it themselves, reaching out to other people and saying, hey, it's not bad. There's not a stigma if you seek mental care. Are there things like that you've seen working with people of color with peer support?
Yes, I think there's a better connection to be had when it's coming from someone who's been through what you've been through, both in just understanding of what you could be looking at in yourself. How has someone arisen above the issue? How did they learn about their issue in the first place? How to navigate when you should look to a physician or a clinician or a therapist or to other avenues of wellness that help improve your sense of self-agency, which is an aspect of depression care too, in terms of behavioral activation. So I think that's in a way better, you know, better swallowed by people who may be afraid due to significant real history we have to reckon with in terms of medicine and disparities and racialized approaches to care that were based on erroneous biological ideas of race that led to stereotypes and bled into physicians and clinicians' ideas of particular people's races and their characteristics. If it's coming from someone from your community or from a faith leader or from somebody who's been through what you've been through and can meet you at your level and where you're at, you can see better outcomes. And there's work that's being done here to help facilitate that community support in terms of education and classwork even at UW.
We're talking to UW Health psychiatrist Dr. Ketty Thirdis about mental health disparities in Wisconsin facing people of color. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. How can we make access to mental health care, to screenings, more equitable? Have you been involved in a peer support type program in your community, wherever you are in the state? What questions do you have for our guest? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Dr. Ketty Thirdis, Associate Clinical Professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health and a psychiatric consultant at UW Health Pain Management Clinic. She's with us today to talk about some of the causes of and potential solutions for mental health disparities facing people of color in Wisconsin and around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about access to mental health care? Do you think we're doing enough to screen for mental health concerns? If you work in the health profession, do you see enough screenings, enough access to services out there? Join in with your experiences or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Thirdis, I know some of your own work involves emergency rooms. And when someone comes in with a mental health emergency or a physical health problem, for that matter, maybe related to a mental health concern, helping connect them with services, not just treating the physical injury. What kind of things are you hoping to see?
So historically, Black people enter mental health care more frequently through emergency and involuntary ways than the general population. So this is an aspect that's near and dear to my heart, working in the emergency room, having to navigate someone who's coming in crisis, who may or may not have an awareness of what's going on, in an emergency room that can be loud and destabilizing and scary with potentially law enforcement involvement. And law enforcement involvement may relate to also involuntary admissions. And typically, as a psychiatrist, you don't want to see someone in a hospital unless they absolutely need to be. The goal is always to promote wellness in the community. But at times, some people need treatment and some people might not understand it. Historically, law enforcement have the power to bring people and commit people against their will. In Wisconsin, there has been movement recently, in Dane County at least, to have less of a police presence involved in mental health crisis responses in the community. When someone calls for help, having an alternative to police and having clinicians who are mentally health trained for crisis management who are not police officers, who can have a more holistic and less intimidating approach to someone in crisis, and to avoid some of the fears that can happen when a police presence is involved. So I think there is good movement towards that. I think it stemmed a lot from understanding the history and understanding the needs of people, and also to have work that's trauma informed as well, given that there is a higher chance of having trauma and trauma responses in the Black community, particularly in underserved areas.
Going from emergency rooms to primary care, I know there have been some efforts to boost screenings, not just for people of color, but across the board for depression and other mental health concerns. Is that something you see as a positive step?
I definitely see it as a positive step. I think a lot of work has been done for improving access to care outside of a psychiatric clinic and embedding it into a medical clinic, where people might feel more comfortable reviewing their care from a holistic approach when their primary doctor is attentive to both their mind and their body, and being able to practice in a way where you're looking at the physical symptoms, but having attention to the mental health aspects of it, the role that the depression can play in the presentation of medical illness, and having access to what is, you know, has been built as collaborative care models, where there are mental health clinicians that help to support and discuss cases with primary care doctors to provide psychiatric and behavioral health treatment recommendations, whether that's diagnostic assessment, whether that's medication recommendations, or whether that's therapy recommendations to improve health outcomes and have people have access to care in a way that they don't necessarily have to get to the psychiatric clinic. Because we do have to be aware that while we'd like to have more psychiatrists, that's not the case both nationally and globally. More psychologists, that's not the case both nationally and globally. And if you look at the breakdown of even Black psychiatrists and psychologists, the percentage of Black psychiatrists is not representative of the population. And that's the same for psychologists as well.
Talking to Dr. Ketty Thurtist with UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at mental health disparities in the United States, here in Wisconsin in particular. Dr. Thurtist, getting back to the issue you just raised again, the idea of having more people of color as practitioners themselves. People might think, well, why does that really matter? If somebody's trained, if somebody is skilled in dealing with mental health problems, it shouldn't matter. Why does it matter?
It's very important historically. It doesn't always matter. And sometimes you have to have the reality of who you're doing, and you can connect with people even if there's differences. But in general, the more informed someone is of someone's background, of their cultural leanings, of their religious leanings, the more informed you can be about how they're navigating their world. And so it avoids overdiagnosis. There's an excellent example of what misdiagnosis can look like. In Michigan, Black protesters in the civil rights era were overdiagnosed with schizophrenia because they felt like their concerns about racism and the structure of racism and its impact were delusional. And so Black patients were overdiagnosed with schizophrenia in the 60s. And this was stemming from a lack of understanding, a lack of awareness, potentially intentional disregard for the experience of Black people. And so it'd be interesting to know if there were Black physicians available at that time or clinicians, would that lead to decreased diagnosis? That's for certain, because there's certain experiences that can be accessed by a culturally informed clinician. So it's not to say that someone has to have someone that looks like them. The reality is that's not going to be the case, but it could go a long way of improving the numbers to have that access be even available for those who would want that or who could benefit from that.
How about deeper structural problems? It's hard as it is to maybe train up a new generation of practitioners and supply more access to care. An even deeper problem might be longer-term structural problems that might lead to some of these problems in the first place. How big a factor are those?
So if you look at what does health and wellness require, and it's multiple issues, it's multiple points of intervention, starting with the nature versus nurture approach to care and to how people can flourish, you know, how much of it is your disposition, how much of it is your upbringing. It's always a complex interplay of both. But if you look at what we use in psychiatry as a biological, psychological, social, and existential formulation of care, looking at biology that looks at the systems and the access to clean food, clean water, clean air, clean communities, safe communities, access to resources, so employment, jobs, equal pay, a sense of existential belonging.
Thanks for calling Central Time. Can I get
Sorry, we had a wire cross there, Dr. Thiertis. Sorry about that interruption there. I wanted to ask about, you know, we hear these reports about disparities in things like mental health care among races, I think again and again over time. Do you have a sense that there is a sense of urgency to solve this problem among your colleagues in the health profession and beyond?
Yes, I've definitely noticed a sense of urgency. I think there's been an enhanced sense of urgency in the last few years between the pandemic and the, I guess, racial reckoning that's happened in America. Within my department, I see a lot of effort. And amongst my colleagues, there is also a lot of talk about what we as Black clinicians can do. So I think there's a good energy. I think the work can be challenging because there's so much and so much to be looked at and so much to be fixed. But I think if we focus on our communities and our strengths, and also to respect the despite the disparities, that there is an inherent strength to minoritized communities, what has been overcome, and the particular positive aspects of cultures that can promote wellness despite the odds, has to be respected and used in our care.
And just in our last minute, Dr. Thiertis, we're talking about people of color with mental health concerns. How important, when we're finding solutions to these disparities, is it to make sure we include people of color with mental health problems in finding those solutions?
I think it is absolutely essential. And that's particular work I'm interested in and would like to move into. I think it's important to fund Black clinicians to do the research and to do the work. I think it's important to engage the community and give a sense of both clinical and civic engagement, a sense of meaningfulness to the work as well, so that despite all the work that has to be done, both clinicians and the population have a sense of agency and support.
Dr. Thiertis, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. Take care. Thank you for having me.
That's Dr. Ketty Thiertis, Associate Clinical Professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health and a psychiatric consultant at UW Health Pain Management Clinic. She was with us today to explore disparities in mental health treatment for people of color in Wisconsin and discuss some potential solutions. Coming up after the news, find out what a survey of Wisconsin businesses can tell us about the labor market here in the state. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You can follow these conversations all the time online at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. You're listening to the Ideas Network.